Today is officially George Washington's birthday observed, not President's Day. Our guest historian will explain the significance of the third Monday in February, and we'll discuss our U.S. presidents, past, present, and future. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's good to be back with you on this Monday, February 16th. We'll also discuss some of the lesser-known facts about our U.S. presidents and our commanders-in-chief, and we will welcome your questions and comments. What do you think makes a great president? Which president are you most fond of and why? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Kenneth C. Davis, the author of the Don't Know Much About book series, including Don't Know Much About the American Presidents. He's also written about the Bible, mythology, the universe, the Civil War, and other topics. His next book is The Hidden History of America at War, Untold Tales from Yorktown to Fallujah, which is coming out in May. Good morning.
Good morning. It's always a pleasure to be with you, Joy.
It's great to have you back. My calendar says today is President's Day, but you argue that's not really the case. It's technically Washington's birthday. What's the story here?
That is the way it appears on the national federal calendar. So we have lots of signs with an apostrophe or without after president. But it is Washington's birthday because it was the only day dedicated to a president. It was a national holiday on Washington's birthday, which used to be celebrated on February 22nd. In 1968, we had something called the Uniform Holidays Act, which created all of the Monday holidays, the three-day weekend holidays that we all know and love. And Washington's birthday was one of those. It got moved to the third Monday in February. A lot of people, for some reason, thought that they were taking Lincoln's birthday, February 12th, and combining it with Washington's birthday for a new holiday called President's Day. But that's not accurate in terms of the official federal designation of this day. So the curiosity there, of course, is that Washington's birthday can never fall on Washington's real birthday because the latest it can be is the 21st.
Yeah, that's right. And it's actually, what, the 22nd is his real...
That's correct. The February 22nd is George Washington's official birthday. But, of course, it's a small matter, but unfortunately, we're going to see lots of pictures of Abraham Lincoln and George Washington with their axes out, chopping prices on everything from cars to mattresses this weekend, because that's what we do with historic holidays.
That's right. I just saw a commercial, in fact, last night with some children singing the names of all of the presidents, and they were selling Jeeps.
Well, that's the American way, isn't it? What good is it if we can't sell something around
yeah.
it? But, you know, it's not... Certainly not a solemn holiday like Memorial Day or even Veterans Day to a degree in terms of it being a day of remembrance. But I think it is a good opportunity for a teaching moment about presidents. We think about them, we talk about them, we think we know about them, and some of them are utterly obscure. They probably are not as important in some respects, or they get too much credit for what goes right and too much blame for what goes wrong very often, but it still is a fascinating piece of American history.
It is, and we'll talk a little bit about all of them, or as many of them as we can, but let's start with George Washington. We know he's our first president. We know, or at least we were told, he cannot tell a lie. What's an important thing about him that people generally don't know?
Well, the cannot tell a lie story, of course, comes from that cherry tree story, which was a fiction created by a fellow named Parson Weems, who had no direct knowledge of Washington. He was writing morality tales for children at the turn of the 19th century, right after Washington's death. Of course, the most admired and famed man in America at his death. Interesting about Washington's true childhood and his relationship with his father is that his father died when he was 11, and Washington wrote and said little about his father in his lifetime. One passing reference, he said he was a tall man who was kindly, and that's about it. Of course, when Washington's father, Gus Washington, died, at Washington was 11. He inherited a small property called Ferry Farm, and with it, 10 slaves that were his own personal property then. Of course, this is the great contradiction in American history that so many, especially of the early presidents, were slaveholders, and we have to take that into account when we're talking about Washington. More important, I think, in terms of the presidency is, of course, the fact that Washington was there in Philadelphia in 1787 when the presidency was created. He was sitting at the front of the room where the delegates were debating the Constitution and said very little in public for the record, but was very, very influential in shaping things. And everyone knew in 1787 when they were talking about the presidency and what it would become that Washington would be the first one. Benjamin Franklin says, "We know who the first man at the helm will be, and he will be a good one. After that, who knows, we'll probably be on the way to an elected monarchy."
Oh, well, so Washington was the first. Does he, because of that designation, deserve to be on the list of the greatest?
I think he's on the list of the greatest, and I certainly ranked him in don't know much about the American presidents. I rank all the presidents with a letter grade, not numerically. So Washington is one of the A-plus presidents. And you have to start first with the idea that he really invented the office, in a sense, and he was aware of that, that everything that he was doing was creating a precedent for the president, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And he said even to a friend, "I walk on untrodden ground." He was very, very cognizant of the idea that he would be establishing rules and ideas and traditions that would last for a long time. And that's why for a very, very long time, no president served more than two terms, because Washington had set that limit. Of course, the Constitution at that time did not limit the presidency to two terms. So Washington was very cognizant of that. He also has to be given credit for the fact that he did leave after two terms. He was certainly ready to leave. He was getting on in years and tired. He had been in service for a very long time. So there's no question that he could have been president for life if he chose. He could have been an elected monarch. And so I think we have to give him a great deal of credit for that. And certainly many of his policies, really in terms of creating the first American government, have to be considered tremendous successes.
I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Ken Davis, who is the author of the Don't Know Much About book series, including Don't Know Much About the American Presidents. And we are talking about the American presidents with him. You can, too, if there's a question you might have about one of our presidents, or if there is a particular president you think was the greatest. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Joe in Milwaukee joins us. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I get called up just to make an observation. Your guest mentioned it briefly in indicating that Washington chose not to the family, in a sense, become a monarch. But the reality of the historical development of the office, and I'm sure your guest knows this, but most Americans don't, is most of the evolution of the office itself comes out of England, George III, where England was was gradually changing its form of government after the Great Glorious Revolution of 1688, and they were pushing the king further and further, or the monarchy, out of any kind of real force or power. And Americans had a very opposite attitude towards the office of monarch and blamed George III for most of the problems. The Declaration of Independence is a good indication of that. And so they decided to establish a system of government which is today probably the most peculiar in the Western world. In other words, we have a head of state and head of government in one person, where the other systems, like in England, gradually forced the monarchy into more just of a symbol. And so I guess my observation is not to rain on anybody's parade, but I do think the parliamentary system has much more to speak to, you know, a flexibility of government. In other words, if we had it, we'd have a president, but he would or she would reside in the White House and be a figurehead, and we have probably a prime minister who would be head of government, head of his party or her party.
Yeah.
And,
let me get Ken to react to that. Would we be better off with a parliamentary system, Ken?
Well, it was certainly a question that was debated in 1787, in secret, by the way, behind locked doors and closed windows in Philadelphia. Washington himself said, gentlemen, be careful when somebody dropped some notes and left them on the floor. Be careful that our deliberations don't get into the newspapers.
I'm going to have to jump in, though, Ken, because we have a newscast coming up, and then we will return talking more about our American presidents. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Happy President's Day. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are discussing our greatest and maybe not so great presidents during this hour, past, present, and future. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Ken Davis, who is the author of the Don't Know Much About book series, including Don't Know Much About the American Presidents. If you have a question about one of our presidents or would like to celebrate a particular president, a favorite president, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Well, Ken, just before our news break, we heard from Joe in Milwaukee, who I think was essentially saying that George Washington really just took over the role of King George and thought maybe the U.S. might be better under a parliamentary system than our system of government. And you were saying?
Well, just quickly, that in 1787, they were really thinking about these things and thinking carefully about them, and they deliberately didn't want a parliamentary system because they felt, ironically, today we could say that it was too political. That faction would, as what they called parties at that time, would really be determining too much. They wanted the president because they wanted an executive who could act with what Alexander Hamilton called vigor. In other words, someone who could step in and respond quickly to an emergency or crisis, whether it's an invasion or an attack or in negotiations. Whereas Congress would be deliberating and dickering over things for weeks, even back then, the president would be someone who could act more quickly. And that's what they wanted to create in the presidency. And I think probably it's fair to say that most of the framers of the Constitution would be very surprised at what they have wrought.
Well, we'll maybe we'll talk a little bit more about the power of the presidency, and especially when it comes to war powers in a little bit later in the program. But let's talk a little bit more about our past presidents. And you mentioned that one fact that we don't know a lot about George Washington was that he was a slave owner. I know that that's one of your areas of interest, the connection between presidents and slavery. Abe Lincoln certainly had a connection to slavery too, didn't he?
Well, in terms of his dislike for it,
yeah.
But it's important to remember we kind of gloss over the relationship between presidents and slavery, both personally and politically on a much larger scale. Five of the first seven presidents were slaveholders, 10 of the first 14 were slaveholders, and most presidents before Lincoln were sympathetic to the slaveholding South. Why is that? Well, go back to your sixth grade civics lessons when they taught you about the Three-Fifths Compromise. Slavery was included in the Constitution without mentioning it for the purpose of determining how many seats a state would have in Congress. That also determines how many electors a state has. This meant that a state like Virginia, in a practical sense, had more congressmen and hence more electors than it would if it had not counted its slaves as three-fifths of a person. That is why Thomas Jefferson was called in 1801, the Negro president, because there were those who believed he'd only been elected because of the advantage given to the slave-holding states. Washington and Jefferson in particular, slaveholders who knew that their slaves represented a contradiction to what they had been fighting for, what they believed in. Washington certainly believed slavery would end, as a great many of the founders and framers did, in that they were, of course, tragically wrong.
Let me get that straight. You said Jefferson was called the first Negro president.
He was called the Negro president by a Federalist in Massachusetts because he had been elected by the slaveholding, with the predominant role of the slaveholding states, which had electors that were based on the number of slaves in those states as well as the free white population.
I'm Joy Cardine talking with Ken Davis. He is the author of, among many other books, Don't Know Much About the American Presidents. And we are learning more about our American presidents on this President's Day, or technically George Washington's birthday. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. James on Facebook writes, FDR got us through a depression and a war. And he followed that up with, under FDR's leadership, we became a great nation. So, comments on FDR, Ken?
Well, FDR, Franklin D. Roosevelt, is one of the four presidents, as I think I mentioned. I grade them all from A-plus down to F with a few incompletes, and Franklin D. Roosevelt is one of the four A-plus presidents, precisely for the reasons that the guest mentioned, the caller mentioned. Roosevelt saw the country through the two greatest crises of the 20th century, the Great Depression and World War II. He did it with a style and a sense that is probably been unequaled since. Of course, there are a great many people in this country, including today, who think that he took the country down the wrong road as opposed to making it a great nation. And that's really the debate we've been having over the last 30 years or so since the time of Ronald Reagan's ascendance. But as I said, I put Roosevelt in the top rank, along with the other Roosevelt, Theodore.
Oh, you do. Well, I know the last time we spoke, I think you said that President Obama gets an incomplete at this point, or at the point you wrote the book. Does he still have that incomplete?
Officially speaking, yes. He still has an incomplete because we haven't finished his term. I believe you cannot judge a full presidency on 6 of 8 years. If, for instance, if you looked at Lyndon Johnson in 1966, when he had still 2 years to go, he probably would have been ranked among the greatest presidents. He just completed a landslide victory, passed major civil rights legislation, and of course, 2 years later, in 1968, the wheels had come off the war in Vietnam, and Johnson was a broken man. And even though the assessment of him today has changed somewhat, has to be considered a largely unsuccessful presidency. So that's why waiting till they're completely done is the only way to do it fairly.
Let's go to JP in Kenosha now. Hello, JP.
Hi, Joy. Thanks for taking my call. With some of the potential presidents that are looking to run, I had a question for our historian. How far back in history do we have to go to find a president that doesn't have a degree or a four-year education?
Yeah, a college degree.
College degree or a four-year education. Well, I'm not sure about a four-year education. Certainly, a college degree, you'd have to go back to, the last president without a college degree.
The last I heard it was Truman who did not have.
Truman did not have a college degree and had a very fundamental high school education. And so that is exactly right, Joy.
Yeah. Well, we're going to open up a little bit of a can of worms here, but do you have any thoughts on the attention that is being given to the fact that Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, who is planning on running for president, I think we can rest assured in saying that, does not have a college degree, and he's getting a lot of press about that.
That fact hasn't been widely or nationally made clear yet, so that's interesting to me. More to the point, I think, is that he's a governor, and historically speaking, especially in the last century or so, governors have really been the seedbed for presidents. We think of vice presidents, but actually vice presidents, except those who succeed to the presidency, has not been a good path to the White House for the most case. Sorry, Mr. Biden, if he's really thinking about it. In fact, before George H.W. Bush became president after Ronald Reagan, you had to go back to Martin Van Buren for the last vice president who was elected in his own right, not succeeding to the presidency. But governors have traditionally been the way. Now, there are a great many, of course, failed candidates who were governors as well. But in recent years, of course, Clinton, Carter, Ronald Reagan, all former governors who then made the leap from State House to White House.
Have any sitting governors run for president and won?
Let's see. Sitting governors, I think you'd have to go back a ways to get to a sitting governor. But no, actually more of the sitting governors have been unsuccessful than successful.
Yeah. Well, that issue, I suppose, could come up a little bit later as well when we talk a little bit about qualities that make a great president. We are talking about presidents on this President's Day with Ken Davis, who is the author of the Don't Know Much About book series, including Don't Know Much About the American Presidents. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. What do you want to know about the U.S. presidency or a particular president? Do you have a favorite president? Do you think one of our presidents was the greatest of all? Let us know. Let's talk a little bit about President Obama this past Wednesday asked Congress to authorize the use of military force against the Islamic State. Talk some about the significance of that.
Well, that's a great question and a great point, because when we're talking about the history of the presidency and going back to 1787 and what they talked, this was the argument back then, and we've been having it for the more than 230 years or 225 years since. And so that's how important this issue is. When they created the presidency and wanted to make the executive the commander-in-chief, that really frightened a lot of people right away. They thought this is surely the way to a kingship, a general who is also in charge of the government. And that really gave them the willies more than any other idea, I think. So that's when this dual system where the president is commander-in-chief, but Congress has the ability to declare war, was introduced as a notion of the check and balance, that the balance of power that Congress would retain. Of course, many presidents over that 200-plus years have taken us in all sorts of directions without declarations of war. A lot of people are surprised to learn that there have only been 5 declarations of war in American history, even though we've had so many conflicts and involvements, especially in the last 50 years, that have not been declared wars. So it's something that's gone back and forth a great deal. I mentioned Lyndon Johnson taking us into Vietnam, basically on the an extension of John F. Kennedy sending in advisors, and then we had the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which gave LBJ almost unlimited powers to wage war without calling it war. A few years later, then Congress said, "Wait a minute, we have to pull back here," and created the War Powers Act for just that reason. That so when a president sends troops or makes a military commitment, he still is supposed to get an authorization from Congress after a certain period of time.
Well, how soon we forget, Ken. Bill Martin's looked it up and found out that, at least from his source, that George W. Bush was the last sitting governor to win the presidency. And Bill Clinton did it too in 1992. Before that, though, it was FDR in 1932.
I forgotten that George W. Bush was actually still the governor. You know, because running for president is such a full-time job, it's difficult to mm-hmm. run for president and run a state. But interesting. Thank you, Bill.
Yeah. Stephen Rice Lake wants to know if you know who the last president to command troops in battle was.
Well, yes, I do, and it's splitting hairs a little bit. George Washington led troops for the first time, and really only time, when he led troops in the Whiskey Rebellion, this uprising of farmers who didn't want to pay taxes on the whiskey they were producing. In the War of 1812, James Madison was present at a battle, the Battle of Bladensburg. And so he wasn't actually commanding the troops, but he was in the field of a true field of battle and had to make a very hasty retreat because it was such a disaster. But those are the only two instances of a president actually being on the battlefield in a position of command.
You know, we've talked about certainly some of the better-known presidents so far, but is there a president who you think is overlooked?
One of my favorite overlooked presidents, I think, is McKinley. He's overlooked because he was so totally overshadowed by the man who succeeded him. Of course, McKinley was assassinated. His place was then taken by Theodore Roosevelt, a very young man, a very brash man, who then became a larger-than-life presidency. And when we think about the modern presidency, it really almost begins with Theodore Roosevelt. He put the presidency in a spotlight, partly because media was coming around very early films and photography and newspapers being able to cover presidents in a new way. Roosevelt, Theodore Roosevelt, raised the presidency to a global position as it had never been before. And that tends to overlook McKinley's accomplishments. A Civil War veteran, the last of the Civil War veterans to serve as president, really created an awful lot of what we think of as modern presidents. Very successful in his first term, easily won re-election, and then, of course, was assassinated by an anarchist. And so McKinley gets overlooked and somewhat overshadowed.
Yeah. Well, is there a president that you are most fascinated by?
I think that still has to be Abraham Lincoln. A childhood fascination just went on to become an adult fascination. Of course, a great many people share that fascination. I believe that Lincoln is still the most written about of American presidents between Lincoln and the Civil War. But the extraordinary story of the rags to riches, the poor boy to the presidency story, Lincoln's ability as a writer, unparalleled, I think, in the presidency, and of course dealing with the greatest crisis in American history, with secession and the coming of the Civil War, and doing it with humanity, humility, and tremendous humor at times, even though it was the grimmest of days in American history.
We're going to check news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we'll continue talking about our greatest presidents. Maybe we'll talk a little bit about our not-so-great presidents. And we'll talk, what do you want to see? What are the qualities in a great president? What makes someone a great president? We'll talk a little bit about the future presidents as well. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with historian Ken Davis. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Today is officially George Washington's birthday, not President's Day, but we have come to treat this third Monday in February as a day to talk about our U.S. presidents. And we are doing just that with Ken Davis, author of the Don't Know Much About book series, including Don't Know Much About the American Presidents. He's also written a number of other books. His next book is The Hidden History of America at War, Untold Tales from Yorktown to Fallujah, and that's coming out in May. If you have a question or a thought on one of our U.S. presidents, 1-800-642-1234. Is there a president that you are particularly fond of and why? Or do you think maybe you have a thought about one of our presidents who didn't do a great job? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Let's go next to Matt in Madison. Hi, Matt.
Hi. I had a question, Joy, about, well, just more of a comment, about the Grover Cleveland, the president who was elected and then unelected and then elected again. And I remember going through, when I was a kid, going through books on the presidency and always being fascinated by that and sort of how that kind of showed the fickleness of the American people. And I was just wondering if your guest had any more comments. Anything else on that you would like to share?
All right, so that happened with Grover Cleveland, Ken?
Fascinating character. When you asked me about overlooked presidents, Grover Cleveland is probably also on that list. Fascinating for a number of reasons. First of all, he was elected even though in the late 19th century, Victorian America, it was revealed he had fathered a child out of wedlock. This was a publicly made scandal. Cleveland said, tell them the truth. Wasn't even sure if he was, in fact, the child's father, but was paying for the child. And you would think, well, that must have been a death sentence for a politician at that time. But no, he was elected. Lost the election to William Henry Harrison, one of the most tainted, scandal-ridden elections in American history. Ballot boxes found floating in rivers, lots of cash being spent. And then as he was getting ready to leave the White House to make way for Harrison, his young wife said, don't move the furniture. We'll be back in 4 years. And she was absolutely correct. Another fascinating little piece about Cleveland is something he wouldn't get away with today, of course. He had jaw cancer and had surgery performed on a boat in the East River. And they did this in secret because they thought if word got out that the president was having surgery, it would ruin the markets at a time that the economy was in some trouble. So they kept his surgery a complete secret. Probably something a president wouldn't get away with today.
Speaking of, I don't know, the electorate and a fickle electorate, maybe at that. Any thoughts on? I guess, give me your thoughts on how unusual it is that we have right now a Democratic president and a full bore Republican majority Congress.
It's gone back and forth a great deal over history, although tens most presidents, certainly in the last 50 years, have had largely Democratic Congresses to deal with. Republican control over both houses has been unusual in the past. And, of course, the great pieces of compromise often come when there are presidents with opposing parties. And you think of Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill doing some very, very big deals together, Tip O'Neill then being the Democratic House Speaker. So it is part of a legacy of what a president can accomplish when he has an opposition Congress. Lyndon B. Johnson was the beneficiary of having a big Democratic majorities when he was president, of course, coming out of the Senate himself, where he was known as the master of the Senate. He had a much easier time getting some of that legislation through and getting Congress to go along with what he did. Easier in those days, also, the president had a few more levers to pull in terms of patronage and money to spread around. We've come a long way from some of those days as well.
How about the polarization that we see today? Is Is that all that unusual?
I don't think it's unusual, and it's certainly not the most divided the country has ever been. So I'm always interested to hear people bemoaning how divided we are. Obviously, you go back 150 years ago, and the country was divided to the point that we had a war that killed 2% of the population. That's truly division. I certainly remember 1968. We were talking about that earlier, and Lyndon Johnson, how divided the country was over Vietnam to the point that, you know, there was rioting in the streets at the political conventions, rioting on campuses that ultimately resulted, unfortunately, in the deaths at Kent State and Mississippi State. So we've been far more divided in the past. Certainly think of the civil rights era and the divisions there. Eisenhower having to send troops in to defend a federal court desegregation order. Think about George Wallace and Selma, as we're reminded in a new film. So we've been far more divided as a country. I think the white-hot glare of 24-hour news and Twitter and Facebook and social media really accentuates a divide to a degree that I think it might be greater than perhaps it is, because the voices on the farthest end seem to be the loudest.
Yeah, I mean we've heard President Obama labeled the least respected U.S. president in history. There was a poll last summer that was taken. In fact, we talked to you about it, where President Obama was called the worst president since World War II. I know you say President Obama deserves an incomplete because he hasn't finished his presidency, but is that unusual that there's so much criticism of a sitting president?
Not at all. I mean, I guess the best case to look back is Harry Truman, who was really at probably at the low point when he could have run for re-election, what essentially would have been a third term, because the term limit amendment did not apply to him. He chose not to, in part because his popularity was so low. He was ready to get out, and so he was deemed, even in his day, as a failed president. Of course, now Truman has undergone a tremendous reassessment, and many people, including me, consider him one of the best presidents. And so the snapshot at any moment in history is really something that I, as someone who tries to look at the big picture and certainly looking backwards sometimes with perspective, sees things differently. Popularity can swing wildly. I was surprised a few years ago to see that George W. Bush, who left office very, very unpopular because of the disasters in Iraq and the disaster in the economy, had gained popularity. So we have short historical memories, I suppose.
Michael in Duluth called in to say that he thought presidents used to do what was right regardless of how popular it was with the public. Now, he says, they seem to look at the polls and only act on what's popular. Have you noticed any shift in leadership like this, Ken?
Polling is one thing, and certainly doing what is popular is another thing. But, you know, there are great moments in our past when presidents have not been able to act because the popular will was so far against it. I guess the best case would be Franklin Roosevelt, certainly wanted to bring the nation much more in line with England in opposing Hitler much earlier, and was unable to because it was unpopular. I don't know if they polled it, but they certainly knew that the country didn't want to get involved in another war in Europe at the time. So there's a clear case of sometimes presidents maybe not being afraid to act, but being unable to act because of the public will.
Charles on Facebook writes, I remain a great fan of President Carter. He is immensely intelligent and thoughtful. More importantly, he demonstrates compassion for others. He was farsighted in his approach to both the environment and fossil fuels. He was the last president to honestly and sincerely ask Americans to consider curbing their appetite for materialism. So brief thoughts on Jimmy Carter.
Jimmy Carter, widely viewed as a failed president, one of the interesting, perhaps most interesting cases of a president who's accomplished so much more in a way since he left the presidency, both in his right, although obviously controversial in some of his writings and some of his views, has been an extraordinary spokesperson for human rights, I think, is the best way to describe him since he left the presidency. And I guess the lesson there is Americans don't want to hear their president say, I'm coming to you to tell you what you have to give up. You know, we used to trumpet that notion that John F. Kennedy used in his famous inaugural address about asking what you can do for your country. That doesn't fly very well, even though it's a great soundbite from a presidential inaugural.
Yeah. So we have a minute to go. You get to tell us who's going to be the next president.
Who's going to be the next president? I have a very poor track record at crystal ball. We're much better at looking at the past, although I did call George Bush fairly early on in that election cycle. You know, it was just around this time that Barack Obama declared for the presidency back in 2007, and, you know, no one gave him any chance because at that time Hillary Clinton was the presumptive nominee. So we know that some strange place, maybe somebody will declare, and we haven't even heard about it yet.
And when we do, we'll call you back. All right.
Thanks very much
for being with us. Ken Davis, author of the Don't Know Much About book series, including Don't Know Much About the American Presidents. His next book, coming out in May, is The Hidden History of America at War, Untold Tales from Yorktown to Fallujah. We should have him on again then when that book comes out. Thanks to Bill Martins and to Caleb Lato for producing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.